almost every aspect of it with other Apaches from Cibicu. This is not to imply that all Apache people interpret their hunting metaphor for storytelling in exactly the same fashion. On the contrary, one of the properties of any successful metaphor is that it can be refined and enlarged in different ways. Thus, some Apaches assert that historical tales, like arrows, leave wounds, mental and emotional wounds, and that the process of replacing oneself is properly understood as a form of healing. Other Apache consultants stress that place names, rather than the sites to which the names refer, are what individuals are unable to forget after historical tales have done their work. But differences and elaborations of this kind only demonstrate the scope and flexibility of the hunting metaphor, and do nothing to alter its basic contours or to diminish its considerable force. Neither does such variation reduce in any way the utility of the metaphor as an effective instrument of Western Apache thought. Although I cannot claim to understand the full range of meanings that the hunting model for storytelling has for Western Apache people, the general premises on which the model rests seem clear to me. Historical tales have the capacity to thrust socially delinquent persons into periods of intense critical self-examination, from which, ideally at least, they emerge chastened, repentant, and determined to live right. Simultaneously, people who have been shot with stories experience a form of anguish, shame, guilt, perhaps only pervasive chagrin, that moves them to alter aspects of their behavior so as to conform more closely to community expectations. In short, historical tales have the power to change people's ideas about themselves, to force them to admit to social failings, to dwell seriously on the significance of these lapses, and to resolve, it is hoped, once and for all, not to repeat them. As Nick Thompson says, historical tales make you think about your life. After stories and storytellers have served this beneficial purpose, features of the physical landscape take over and perpetuate it. Mountains and arroyos step in symbolically for grandmothers and uncles. Just as the latter have stalked delinquent individuals in the past, so too particular locations continue to stalk them in the present. Such surveillance is essential, Apaches maintain, because living right requires constant care and attention, and there is always a possibility that old stories and their impact, like old arrows and their wounds, will fade and disappear. In other words, there is always a chance that persons who have replaced themselves once or twice or three times will relax their guard against badness and slip back into undesirable forms of social conduct. Consequently, Apaches explain, individuals need to be continuously reminded of why they were shot in the first place and how they reacted to it at the time. Geographical sites, together with the crisp mental pictures of them presented by their names, serve admirably in this capacity, inviting people to recall their earlier failings and encouraging them to resolve once again to avoid them in the future. Grandmothers and uncles must perish, but the landscape endures, and for this the Apache people are grateful. The land, Nick Thompson observes, looks after us. The land keeps the badness away. It should now be possible for the listener to interpret the Western Apache texts at the beginning of this essay in a manner roughly compatible with the Apache ideas that have shaped them. Moreover, he or she should be able to appreciate that the claims put forward in the texts are reasonable and appropriate, credible, and correct. The principled expressions of an underlying logic that invests them with internal consistency and coherent conceptual structure. As we have seen, this structure is supplied in large part by the hunting metaphor for Western Apache storytelling. It is chiefly in accordance with this metaphor, or more exactly, in accordance with the symbolic associations it orders and makes explicit, that the claims presented earlier finally make sense. Thus, Annie Peach's claim that the land occupied by Western Apaches makes the people live right becomes understandable as a proposition about the moral significance of geographical locations, as this has been established by historical tales with which the locations are associated. Similarly, Wilson Lavender's claim that Apaches who fail to remember place names forget how to be strong rests on an association of place names with a belief in the power of historical tales to discourage forms of socially unacceptable behavior. Apaches also associate places and their names with the narrators of historical tales, and Benson Lewis's claim that a certain mountain near Cibicu is his maternal grandmother can be interpreted only in light of this assumption. The hunting metaphor for storytelling also informs Ronnie Loopy's claim that Western Apache children who are not exposed to historical tales tend to have interpersonal difficulties. As he puts it, they don't know the stories of what happened at these places. That's why some of them get into trouble. What Mr. Loopy is claiming, of course, is that children who do not learn to associate places and their names with historical tales cannot appreciate the utility of these narratives as guidelines for dealing responsibly and amicably with other people. Consequently, he believes, such individuals are more likely than others to act in ways that run counter to Apache social norms, a sure sign that they are losing the land. Losing the land is something the Western Apaches can ill afford to do, for geographical features have served the people for centuries as indispensable mnemonic pegs on which to hang the moral teachings of their history. Accordingly, such locations present themselves as instances of what Mikhail Bakhtin has called chronotopes. As Bakhtin describes them, chronotopes are points in the geography of a community where time and space intersect and fuse. Time takes on flesh and becomes visible for human contemplation. Likewise, space becomes charged and responsive to the movements of time and history and the enduring character of a people. Chronotopes thus stand as monuments to the community itself, as symbols of it, as forces operating to shape its members' images of themselves. Whether or not one is pleased with Bakhtin's use of the term chronotope, it is more widely known, but in a very different sense, as a concept in Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. His observations on the cultural importance of geographical landmarks apply nicely to the Western Apache. The Apache landscape is full of named locations where time and space have fused and where, through the agency of historical tales, their intersection is made visible for human contemplation. It is also apparent that such locations, charged as they are with personal and social significance, work in important ways to shape the images that Apaches have or should have of themselves. Speaking to people like Nick Thompson and Ronnie Loopy, to Annie Peaches and Benson Lewis, one forms the impression that Apaches view the landscape as a repository of distilled wisdom, a stern but benevolent keeper of tradition, an ever-vigilant ally in the efforts of individuals and whole communities to maintain a set of standards for social living that is uniquely and distinctly their own. In the world that the Western Apaches have constituted for themselves, features of the landscape have become symbols of and for this way of living, the symbols of a culture and the enduring moral character of its people. We may assume that this relationship with the land has been pervasive throughout Western Apache history, but in today's climate of social change, its importance for Apache people may well be deepening. Communities such as Cibicu, formerly isolated and very much turned inward, were opened up by paved roads less than 25 years ago, and the consequences of improved access and freer travel including greatly increased contact with Anglo-Americans, have been pronounced. Younger Apaches, who today complain frequently about the tedium of village life, have started to develop new tastes and ambitions, and some of them are eager to explore the outside world. Older members of the community understand this desire and do little to try to stifle it, but they are concerned that as younger people learn more and more of the white man's way, they will also lose sight of portions of their own. Let the pink plastic curlers at the girl's puberty ceremonial stand as one case in point. What can be done to guard against this unsettling possibility? Perhaps in the long run, nothing. But for now, and probably for some time to come, the landscape is doing a respectable job. It is there, stalking people, all the time, and to the extent that it remains not merely a physical presence, but an omnipresent moral force, young Apaches are not likely to forget that the white man's way belongs to a different world. Having pursued Western Apache ideas about the land this far, it is worth inquiring whether similar conceptions are held by other groups of American Indian people. Although ethnographic materials bearing on this question are in short supply, I identify some of the reasons for this shortage further on. There is highly reliable evidence from another source, the published work of modern Indian writers, that general similarities do exist. Consider, for example, the following statement by Leslie M. Silco, poet and novelist, from the Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico. After explaining that stories function basically as makers of our identity, Silco goes on to discuss Pueblo narratives in relation to the land. The stories cannot be separated from geographical locations, from actual physical places within the land. And the stories are so much a part of these places that it is almost impossible for future generations to lose the stories because there are so many imposing geological elements. You cannot live in that land without asking or looking at or noticing a boulder or rock. And there's always a story. A number of other American Indian authors, among them Vine Deloria Jr., Standing Rock Sioux, Simon Ortiz, Acoma, Joy Harjo, Creek, and the cultural anthropologist Alfonso Ortiz, San Juan Pueblo, have written with skill and insight about the moral dimensions of Native American conceptions of the land. No one, however, has addressed the subject with greater sensitivity than N. Scott Mamede, Kiowa. The following passages, taken from his short essay entitled Native American Attitudes to the Environment, 1974, show clearly what is involved, not only for the Western Apache, but for other tribes as well. You cannot understand how the Indian thinks of himself in relation to the world around him unless you understand his conception of what is appropriate, particularly what is morally appropriate within the context of that relationship. The Native American ethic with respect to the physical world is a matter of reciprocal appropriation. Appropriations in which man invests himself in the landscape and at the same time incorporates the landscape into his own most fundamental experience. This appropriation is primarily a matter of imagination, which is moral in kind. I mean to say that we are all, I suppose, what we imagine ourselves to be, and that is certainly true of the American Indian. The Indian is someone who thinks of himself in a particular way, and his idea comprehends his relationship to the physical world. He imagines himself in terms of that relationship and others, and it is that act of imagination, that moral act of imagination, which constitutes his understanding of the physical world. Goodness is all around. The news sweeps through Cibique like brush fire. Nick Thompson must have purchased a wheelchair because he was seen this morning racing in one against his 4-year-old grandson. The little boy, shrieking with glee and running as fast as he could, won the contest, but the old man finished close behind. Nick's wife was horrified, and his oldest daughter yelled twice to him to stop, but he kept on going, wheeling himself along with his one good arm and paying no attention whatsoever. That old man will do anything. He doesn't care at all what people think. And what if he crashed? Nick Thompson has no intention of crashing. Seated now in his familiar place beneath the cottonwood tree near his house, he says that racing his wheelchair is perfectly safe. He says he plans to do it again. He has already challenged his 6-year-old granddaughter. He says he is tired of the women in his camp telling him what to do. He is also tired of not being able to move around freely, which is why he bought the wheelchair in the first place, and people should understand this and stop making such a fuss. And besides, the old man observes, the wheelchair has good brakes. That's what he likes best, getting up speed and jamming on the brakes. The summer of 1981 is almost gone, and soon I must leave Cibicue. I have walked to Nick's camp to tell him goodbye. This is never easy for me, and we spend most of the time talking about other things. Eventually, I move to thank him for his generosity, his patience, and the things he has taught me. Nick responds by pointing with his lips to a low ridge that runs behind his home in an easterly direction away from Cibicue Creek. "That is a good place," he says. "These are all good places. Goodness is all around." The old man pauses. Then he reaches beneath the seat of his wheelchair and produces a blue and white cap, which he places slightly askew on his head. The embossed emblem in front, which is in the shape of a car, reads Ford Racing Team. We both begin to laugh. And laugh. And laugh. Language and environment. Anthropologists have long been interested in the relationships that link American Indian communities to their ecological settings. In the great majority of cases, these relationships have been described and interpreted exclusively in materialist terms, that is, in terms of demographic patterns, subsistence strategies, and forms of social organization that facilitate the exploitation of environmental resources and function in this way to assure the biological survival of native populations. While this approach is useful for certain purposes, it is clear that materialist models are one-sided and incomplete. They ignore the fact that American Indians, like groups of people everywhere, maintain a complex array of symbolic relationships with their physical surroundings, and that these relationships, which may have little to do with the business of making a living, play a fundamental role in shaping other forms of social activity. What has been ignored, in other words, are the cultural instruments with which American Indians fashion understandings of their environments. The ideational resources with which they constitute their surroundings and invest them with value and significance. We need not go far to seek the reasons for this neglect, having committed themselves to a search for statistical regularities and functional interdependencies. Human ecologists are obliged to regard the semiotic dimensions of human environments as epiphenomena that lie outside the proper sphere of their concern, and so, ironically, many human ecologists have become largely uninterested in what human beings take their environments to mean. This is unfortunate, because as Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and Edward Rochberg Halton have written, to understand what people are and what they might become, one must understand what goes on between people and things. What things are cherished and why should become part of our knowledge of human beings. Yet it is surprising how little we know about what things mean to people. By and large, social scientists have neglected a full investigation of the relationship between people and objects. There is no doubt in the minds of many anthropologists, including a substantial number who have worked with American Indians, that studies in ecology have made a valuable contribution. In particular, these investigations have shown that indigenous populations may adapt with exquisite intricacy to the physical conditions of their existence, including, of course, the presence of other human populations, and that modifications in these conditions may have a range of dynamic effects on the structure and organization of social institutions. But ecological models have been consistently formulated at a systemic level that is well removed from the level of the individual, and it is individuals, not social institutions, who make and act on cultural meanings. Conventional ecological studies proceed on the tacit premise that what people think about the environment, how they perceive it, how they conceptualize it, or, to borrow a phrase from the ethnomethodologists, how they actively construct it, is basically irrelevant to an understanding of man-land relationships. To accept this premise is to conclude that cultural meanings are similarly irrelevant, and that the layer of significance with which human beings blanket the environment have little bearing on how they lead their lives. But the premise is not correct. For American Indians or anyone else, and to suppose otherwise would be a serious mistake. Accordingly, and by way of illustration, I have attempted to show here that Western Apache conceptions of the land work in specific ways to influence Apaches' conceptions of themselves and vice versa, and that the two together work to influence patterns of social action. To reject this possibility, or as many ecologists would be inclined to do, to rule it out a priori as inconsequential, would have the effect of removing the Apaches from the world as they have constructed it. This in turn would obliterate all aspects of their moral relationship with the land. For reasons that should now be apparent, this relationship is crucial to Apaches. Quite as crucial, I expect, as any that deals with substance or economics, and for us to lose sight of it could only have damaging consequences. Societies must survive, but social life is more than just surviving, and cultural meanings are epiphenomenal only for those who choose to make them so. I would like to witness the development of a cultural ecology that is cultural in the fullest sense, a broader and more flexible approach to the study of man-land relationships in which the symbolic properties of environmental phenomena receive the same kind of attention that has traditionally been given to their material counterparts. The Western Apaches of Sibiku understand their land and act on their understandings of it in ways that standard ecological approaches would overlook. Does this mean that such understandings are unimportant for the Western Apache? For a stronger and more rounded anthropology? I suggest that on both counts, it does not. Cultural constructions of the environment, whether those of American Indians or of peoples elsewhere in the world, will remain largely inaccessible unless we are prepared to sit down and listen to our native consultants talk, not only about landscapes, which of course we must do, but about talking about landscapes as well. And since spatial conceptions, like temporal ones, are so often found expressed in figurative language, this is almost certain to lead to a consideration of metaphor. Paul Radden, writing some years ago of the Winnebago Indians of the Great Lakes, described a particular case that is probably typical of many others. Ideas about the habitat are frequently set forth in elaborate similes and metaphors, which equate disparate objects in a fashion that at first seems quite unfathomable. Yet, once these tropes are uncovered, it can be seen that they rest upon firm assumptions about the workings of nature which, though different from our own, fit together intelligibly. George Lakoff and Mark Johnson have stated that the essence of metaphor is understanding and experiencing one kind of thing in terms of another. Although this definition departs relatively little from the classical one given by Aristotle, metaphor implies an intuitive perception of the similarity in dissimilars. It points to a problem in the study of language and culture that is deeply ethnographic. For where metaphor is concerned, the question always arises, on what grounds is one kind of thing understood in terms of another? In other words, what must individuals believe about themselves and their surroundings for their metaphors to work? This question focuses attention on the large body of implicit cultural assumptions that the members of any speech community rely on to interpret instances of situated discourse. Such assumptions, which have been variously described as comprising a speaker's presuppositions, background knowledge, or beliefs about the world, present difficulties for all theories of language that seek to restrict the idea of linguistic competence to a speaker's tacit knowledge of grammatical rules. Metaphor threatens both the validity of this distinction and the utility of maintaining it, because the ability to interpret even the simplest forms of metaphorical speech cannot be accounted for with grammatical rules alone. Presuppositions are also fundamentally involved. This is clearly illustrated by Nick Thompson's statement on the Western Apache hunting metaphor for storytelling, as he explicates the metaphor, thereby enabling us to interpret a set of claims that Apaches have made. He articulates the cultural assumptions that make these claims possible in the first place. In other words, he makes presuppositions explicit. Storytellers are hunters for the Western Apache, and stories, arrows, and mountains, grandmothers. By virtue of shared beliefs about the world, culturally wrought and culturally specific, such beliefs provide the conceptual materials with which competent Apache speakers locate the similarities in metaphorical dissimilars, and in doing so, experience one kind of thing in terms of another. Such beliefs make their metaphors work. What all of this implies, obviously, for many anthropologists, less so for many linguists, is that grasping other people's metaphors requires ethnography as much as it does linguistics. Unless we pursue the two together, the full extent to which metaphorical structures influence patterns of thought and action is likely to elude us. To inhabit a language, Samuel Johnson wrote, is to inhabit a living universe, and vice versa. That vice versa is crucial because it suggests, correctly I believe, that linguistics and ethnography are integral parts of the same basic enterprise, one of whose purposes is to construct principled interpretations of culturally constituted worlds and to try to understand what living in them is like. If anthropology stands to benefit from an approach to cultural ecology that attends more closely to the symbolic forms with which human environments are perceived and rendered significant, so too there is need for an expanded view of linguistic competence in which beliefs about the world occupy a central place. If it is the meaning of things that we are after, the meanings of words, objects, events, and the claims people make about themselves, language and culture must be studied hand in hand. Our knowledge of one can only enhance our knowledge of the other. We know it happened. If the thoughts presented here have a measure of theoretical interest, recent experience persuades me that they can have practical value as well. During the past decade, I've written a number of documents for use in litigation concerning the settlement of Western Apache water rights in the state of Arizona. Until a final decision is reached in the case, I am not permitted to describe the contents of these documents in detail, but one of my assignments has been to write a report dealing with Apache conceptions of the physical environment. That report contains sections on Western Apache place names, oral narratives, and certain metaphors that Apache people use to formulate aspects of their relationship with the land. Preliminary hearings resulted in a judgment favorable to Apache interests. Apparently, my report was useful, mainly because it helped to pave the way for testimony by Native witnesses. One of these witnesses was Nick Thompson, and according to attorneys on both sides, the old man's appearance had a decisive impact. After Nick had taken his place on the stand, he was asked by an attorney why he considered water to be important to his people. A man of eminent good sense, Nick replied, "Because we drink it." And then, without missing a beat, he launched into a historical tale about a large spring not far from Sibiku, to Nchahinina. Much water flows up and out, where long ago a man was mysteriously drowned after badly mistreating his wife. When Nick finished the story, he went on to say, "We know it happened, so we know not to act like that man who died. It's good we have that water. We need it to live. It's good we have that spring, too. We need it to live right." Then the old man smiled to himself, and his eyes began to dance. 3. Speaking with Names. What we call the landscape is generally considered to be something out there. But while some aspects of the landscape are clearly external to both our bodies and our minds, what each of us actually experiences is selected, shaped, and colored by what we know. Barry Greenby, Spaces, Dimensions of the Human Landscape. An unfamiliar landscape, like an unfamiliar language, is always a little daunting. And when the two are encountered together, as they are commonly enough, in those out-of-the-way communities where ethnographers tend to crop up, the combination may be downright unsettling. From the outset, of course, neither landscape nor language can be ignored. On the contrary, the shapes and colors and contours of the land, together with the shifting sounds and cadences of native discourse, thrust themselves upon the newcomer with a force so vivid and direct as to be virtually inescapable. Yet for all their sensory immediacy, and there are occasions, as any ethnographer will attest, when the sheer constancy of it grows to formidable proportions, landscape and discourse seem resolutely out of reach. Although close at hand and tangible in the extreme, each in its own way appears remote and inaccessible, anonymous and indistinct, and somehow implausibly a shade less than fully believable. And neither landscape nor discourse, as if determined to accentuate these conflicting impressions, may seem the least bit interested in having them resolved. Emphatically there, but conspicuously lacking in accustomed forms of order and arrangement, landscape and discourse confound the stranger's efforts to invest them with significance, and this uncommon predicament, which produces nothing if not uncertainty, can be keenly disconcerting. Surrounded by foreign geographical objects and intractable acts of speech, even the most practiced ethnographer becomes diffident and cautious, for the meanings of objects and acts alike can only be guessed at, and once the guesses have been recognized for the arbitrary constructions they almost always are, one senses acutely that one's own experience of things and events out there cannot be used as a reliable guide to the experience of native people. In other words, One must acknowledge that local understandings of external realities are fashioned from local cultural materials, and that, knowing little or nothing of the latter, one's ability to make appropriate sense of what is and what occurs in another's environment is bound to be deficient. For better or worse, the ethnographer sees landscape and speech acts do not interpret their own significance. Initially, at least, and typically for many months to come, this is a task that only members of the indigenous community are adequately equipped to accomplish, and accomplish it they do day in and day out with enviably little difficulty. For where Native men and women are concerned, the external world is, as it appears to them to be, naturally, unproblematically, and more or less consistently. And rarely do they have reason to consider that the coherence it displays is an intricate product of their own collective manufacture. Cultures run deep, as the saying goes, and all of us take our native's point of view very much for granted. In this way, or something roughly like it, the ethnographer comes to appreciate that features of the local landscape, no less than utterances exchanged in forms of daily discourse, acquire value and significance by virtue of the ideation systems with which they are apprehended and construed. Symbolically constituted, socially transmitted, and individually applied, such systems operate to place flexible constraints on how the physical environment can and should be known, how its occupants can and should be found to act, and how the doings of both can and should be discerned to affect each other. Accordingly, each system delineates a distinctive way of being in the world, an informal logic for engaging the world and thinking about the engagement, an array of conceptual frameworks for organizing experience and rendering it intelligible. In any community, the meanings assigned to geographical features and acts of speech will be influenced by the subjective determinations of the people who assign them, and these determinations, needless to say, will exhibit variation. But the character of the meanings, their steadier themes, their recurrent tonalities, and above all, their conventionalized modes of expression will bear the stamp of a common cast of mind. Constructions of reality that reflect conceptions of reality, the meanings of landscapes and acts of speech, are personalized manifestations of a shared perspective on the human condition. Mulling over these apparent truths, the ethnographer is likely to notice that members of the local community involve themselves with their geographical landscape in at least three distinct ways. First, they may simply observe the landscape, attending for reasons of their own to aspects of its appearance and to sundry goings-on within it. Second, they may use the landscape, engaging in a broad range of physical activities which, depending on their duration and extent, may leave portions of the landscape visibly modified. Third, native people may communicate about the landscape, formulating descriptions and other representations of it that they share in the course of social gatherings. On many occasions, community members can be observed to alternate freely among these different modes of involvement. They may also, of course, combine them, but it is obvious that events in the last mode, communicative acts of topographic representation, will be most revealing of the conceptual instruments with which native people interpret their natural surroundings. And though such representations may be fashioned from a variety of semiotic materials, gestural, pictorial, musical, and others, few are more instructive than those which are wrought with words. Ordinary talk, the ethnographer sees provides a readily available window onto the structure and significance of other people's worlds, and so, slowly at first, by fits and starts, and never without protracted bouts of guessing, he or she begins to learn to listen, and also to freshly see. For as native concepts and beliefs find external purchase on specific features of the local topography, the entire landscape acquires a crisp, new dimension that seems to move it more surely into view. What earlier appeared as a circular sweep of undifferentiated natural architecture now starts to emerge as a precise arrangement of named sites and localities, each distinguished by a set of physical attributes and cultural associations that mark it as unique. In native discourse, the local landscape falls neatly and repeatedly into places, and places, as Franz Boas emphasized some years ago, are social constructions par excellence. It is excessive to claim, as George Traeger has done, that the way man talks about the physical universe is his only way of knowing anything about it. Nonetheless, most ethnographers would agree that Traeger's claim contains a large amount of truth, and some have suggested that this can be seen with particular clarity where language and landscapes are concerned. For whenever the members of a community speak about their landscape, whenever they name it or classify it or tell stories about it, they unthinkingly represent it in ways that are compatible with shared understandings of how, in the fullest sense, they know themselves to occupy it. Which is simply to note that in conversational encounters, brief and lengthy alike, individuals exchange accounts and observations of the landscape that consistently presuppose mutually held ideas of what it actually is, why its constituent places are important, and how it may intrude on the practical affairs of its inhabitants. Thus, if frequently by implication and allusion only, bits and pieces of a common worldview are given situated relevance and made temporarily accessible, in talk about the landscape, as Martin Heidegger so aptly put it, cultural conceptions of dwelling together are placed on oblique display. At the same time, however, and often just as obliquely, persons who engage in this sort of talk also exchange messages about aspects of the social encounter in which they are jointly involved, including their framings of the encounter itself, for example, what is going on here, and their morally guided assessments of the comportment of fellow participants. Consequently, the possibility arises that as speakers communicate about the landscape and the kinds of dealings they have with it, they may also communicate about themselves as social actors and the kinds of dealings they are having with one another. Stated more precisely, statements pertaining to the landscape may be employed to convey tacit messages about the organization of face-to-face relationships and the normative footings on which those relationships are currently being conducted. Indirectly, perhaps, but tellingly all the same, participants in verbal encounters thus put their landscapes to work, interactional work, and how they choose to go about it may shed interesting light on matters other than geography. For example, when a character in a short story by Paul Gallico says to his chronically unfaithful lover, "Go make a nest on 42nd Street," it is altogether clear that he is drawing upon the cultural meaning of a place to communicate something important about their relationship. From the standpoint of the ethnographer, then, situated talk of geographical landscapes is more than a valuable resource for exploring local conceptions of the surrounding material universe. It may, in addition, be useful for interpreting forms of social interaction that regularly occur within that universe. For landscapes are always available to their seasoned inhabitants in more than material terms. Landscapes are available in symbolic terms as well, and so, chiefly through the manifold agencies of speech, they can be detached from their fixed spatial moorings and transformed into instruments of thought and vehicles of purposive behavior. Thus transformed, landscapes and the places that fill them become tools for the imagination, expressive means for accomplishing verbal deeds, and also, of course, eminently portable possessions to which individuals can maintain deep and abiding attachments, regardless of where they travel. In these ways, as N. Scott Momaday has observed, men and women learn to appropriate their landscapes, to think and act with them, as well as about and upon them, and to weave them with spoken words into the very foundations of social life. And in these ways, too, as every ethnographer eventually comes to appreciate, geographical landscapes are never culturally vacant. The ethnographic challenge is to fathom what it is that a particular landscape, filled to brimming with past and present significance, can be called upon to say, and what, through the saying, it can be called upon to do. But where to begin and how to proceed? How in any community to identify the conceptual frameworks and verbal practices with which members appropriate their geography? One promising approach, as I have been suggesting, is to attend to native place names and the full variety of communicative functions served by acts of naming in different social contexts. It may be noted in this regard that place names, or toponyms, comprise a distinct semantic domain in the lexicon of all known languages, and that the formal properties of place name systems, together with their spatial correlates and etymological histories, have long been objects of anthropological inquiry. But the common activity of place naming, the actual use of toponyms in concrete instances of everyday speech, has attracted little attention from linguists or ethnographers. Less often still, has place naming been investigated as a universal means, and it could well turn out a universally primary means for appropriating physical environments. The reasons for this innocuous piece of scholarly neglect are several, but the main one arises from a widespread view of language in which proper names are assumed to have meaning solely in their capacity to refer and as agents of reference to enter into simple and complex predications. Many of the limitations imposed by this narrow conception of meaning have been exposed and criticized in recent years, most ably by linguistic anthropologists and philosophers of language, who have shown that reference, though unquestionably of vital linguistic function, is but one of many that spoken utterances can be made to perform. But despite these salutary developments, and unhappily for students who seek to understand linguistic meaning as an emergent property of verbal interaction, the idea persists in many quarters that proper names, including toponyms, serve as referential vehicles whose only purpose is to denote or pick out objects in the world. If a certain myopia attaches to this position, there is irony as well, for place names are arguably among the most highly charged and richly evocative of all linguistic symbols. Because of their inseparable connection to specific localities, place names may be used to summon forth an enormous range of mental and emotional associations, associations of time and space, of history and events, of persons and social activities, of oneself and stages in one's life, and in their capacity to evoke, in their compact power to muster and consolidate so much of what a landscape may be taken to represent in both personal and cultural terms, place names acquire a functional value that easily matches their utility as instruments of reference. Most notably, as T.S. Eliot and Seamus Heaney have remarked, place names provide materials for resonating ellipses, for speaking and writing in potent shorthand, for communicating much while saying very little. poets and songwriters have long understood that economy of expression may enhance the quality and force of aesthetic discourse, and that place names stand ready to be exploited for this purpose. Linguists and anthropologists would do well to understand that in many communities, similar considerations may influence common forms of spoken interaction, and that in this arena, too, place names may occupy a privileged position. For these and other reasons, an ethnographic approach to the activity of place naming seems well worth pursuing. The present chapter, which now takes a sharp ethnographic turn, is offered as an illustration of where such an approach may lead, and why, beyond the illumination of specific cases, it may also shed light on matters of general interest. Speaking with names. The Western Apache residents of Sibiku are not averse to talking about each other, and some of them, like Lola Machuse, seem to enjoy it immensely. "I'm interested in everybody," Lola will exclaim in her distinctive variety of English, and everyone in Sibiku knows she speaks the truth. Just over 60, she is a handsome woman with large brown eyes, a sharply defined nose, and splendidly shaped hands that are hardly ever still. The mother of 8 children, she divides her time between caring for the needs of her family, collecting plants for use in her herbal medicines, participating in ceremonial activities, and farming. She also keeps fully informed on what happens in her village, and, like other Apache women who have led exemplary lives, is frequently invited to comment on current events. And comment on them, she does. Intelligently, insightfully, usually sympathetically, and with a lively enthusiasm for nuance and detail that is sometimes as amusing as it is mildly overwhelming. Western Apache communities, like small communities everywhere, operate largely by word of mouth, and people from Sibiku have suggested more than once that Lola Machuse is practically a community unto herself. Unfailingly cheerful and completely at ease with herself, she is a compassionate person with a spirited zest for life. It is a hot afternoon in the middle of July, and Lola Machuse is working at home. Seated in the shade of a large brush-covered ramada, she is mending clothes in the company of her husband Robert, 2 Apache women named Emily and Louise, and another visitor, myself, who has come to settle a small debt and get a drink of water. The heat of the afternoon is heavy and oppressive, and there is little to do but gaze at the landscape that stretches out before us. A narrow valley, bisected by a stream, lined with stately cottonwood trees, which rises abruptly to embrace a broken series of red sandstone bluffs, and beyond the bluffs, a flat expanse of grassy plain, ending in the distance at the base of a low range of mountains. Fearsome in the blazing sun, the country around Sibiku lies motionless and inert, thinly shrouded in patches of bluish haze. Nothing stirs except for Clifford, the Machuse's ancient yellow dog, who shifts his position in the dust, groans fitfully, and snaps at a fly. Silence. The silence is broken by Louise, who reaches into her oversized purse for a can of Pepsi-Cola, jerks it open with a loud snap, and begins to speak in the Sibiku dialect of Western Apache. She speaks softly, haltingly, and with long pauses to accentuate the seriousness of what she is saying. Late last night, she reports, sickness assailed her younger brother. Painful cramps gnawed at his stomach. Numbness crept up his legs and into his thighs. He vomited 3 times in rapid succession. He looked extremely pale. In the morning, just before dawn, he was driven to the hospital at White River. The people who had gathered at his home were worried and frightened and talked about what happened. One of them, Louise's cousin, recalled that several months ago, when the young man was working on a cattle roundup near a place named Tsi Biyi Itine, trail extends into a grove of stick-like trees. He had inadvertently stepped on a snakeskin that lay wedged in a crevice between some rocks. Another member of the roundup crew, who witnessed the incident, cautioned the young man that contact with snakes is always dangerous and urged him to immediately seek the services of a snake medicine person, Tlish Biyidin. But Louise's younger brother had only smiled, remarking tersely that he was not alarmed and that no harm would befall him. Louise, who was plainly worried and upset by these events, pauses and sips from her drink. After a minute or so, having regained her composure, she begins to speak again, but Lola Machus quietly interrupts her. Emily and Robert will speak as well. What follows is a record of their discourse, together with English translations of the utterances. Louise, she dije, my younger brother. Lola, tse hadigaye, you agodza. It happened that line of white rocks extend up and out, at this very place. Pause of 30 to 45 seconds. Emily, ha-a, tuji, yahigaye, you agodza. Yes, it happened that whiteness spreads out descending to water. At this very place. Pause of 30 to 45 seconds. Lola. Da ani kis dischi na adinite yu agodza. Truly, it happened that trail extends across a red ridge with alder trees. At this very place. Louise laughs softly. Robert. Gojo doliu. Pleasantness and goodness will be forthcoming. Lola. Gojo doliu, pleasantness and goodness will be forthcoming. Louise, shidije bini yeshid ne goshe? My younger brother is foolish, isn't he? Dog. Following this brief exchange, talk ceases under the brush-covered ramada, and everyone retreats into the privacy of his or her thoughts. Louise drinks again from her can of Pepsi-Cola and passes it on to Emily. Lola Machus returns to her sewing while Robert studies a horse in a nearby corral. Only Clifford, who has launched a feverish attack on an itch below his ear, seems unaffected by what has been said. Silence, once again. But what has been said? To what set of personal and social ends? And why in such a clipped and cryptic fashion? If these questions create problems for us, and I think it can be assumed that they do, it is because we are dealing with a spate of conversation whose organization eludes us, a strip of Western Apache verbal doings whose animating aims and purposes seem obscure. But why? The problem is not that the literal meanings of utterances comprising the conversation are difficult to grasp. On the contrary, anyone with a passing knowledge of Western Apache grammar could attest that each of the utterances is well-formed in all respects and that each presents one or more simple claims whose positive truth value no Apache would presume to dispute. It is not, then, on the surface of the utterances, or as linguists prefer to say, at the level of their propositional content, that our interpretive difficulties lie. What is puzzling about this snippet of Western Apache talk is that we are unable to account for the ways in which its constituent utterances are related to each other. Put more exactly, we lack the knowledge required to establish sequential relations among the utterances, the unstated premises and assumptions that order the utterances, just as they occur, into a piece of meaningful discourse. It is by no means evident, for example, how Lola Machusa's statement, "It happened at line of white rocks extends up and out at this very place," should be related to Louise's narrative about her ailing brother. Neither is it clear how Emily's assertion, "Yes, it happened at whiteness spreads out descending to water at this very place," should be interpreted as a response to the narrative or to Lola's prior statement. What are we to make of Lola's response to Emily? Truly, It happened that trail extends across a red ridge with alder trees at this very place. And why should it be, as things are coming to a close, that Louise sees fit to address the Machusa's dog? Our puzzlement persists throughout, causing us to experience the text of the conversation as fragmented and disjointed, as oddly unmotivated, as failing to come together as a whole. In short, we are unable to place a construction on the text that invests it with coherence, and so, in the end, we cannot know what the conversation itself may have been about. Lola Machusa and her companion